All right, folks, this is Monty Shaw. I'm the Executive Director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association. We got a little feedback there a second ago. If folks would like to use their mute button, if they're not talking, we will be taking questions at the end. But in the meantime, if you wanted to use your mute button, that would be a kindness to the rest of us on the call. I'm just going to make some very brief comments, and then really want to spend the time taking questions. I'll apologize in advance that we don't have one of these big fancy conference call centers where you click a button and get put in a queue and all of that sort of stuff. It's a little bit more of a free-for-all. But we will, unfortunately, I don't have anything more important to do today, so I will stay on the line as long as anyone has a question. So with that, we'll get started. Again, for those that just joined, my name is Monty Shaw. I'm the Executive Director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association. The IRFA is the largest renewable fuels group in Iowa. We represent both ethanol plants and biodiesel plants, as well as next generation plants that are under construction here in the state. And obviously as the number one ethanol and biodiesel producer in the state, as well as number one corn and soybean producer, we have a lot at stake with today's announcement. And the RFS announcement today by the EPA, I think, could be characterized as the biggest policy reversal of the entire Obama administration. The logic that went into it essentially turns the RFS on its head. Instead of a tool used to create market access for renewable fuels, given all the both policy and market advantages that oil has built up over 100 years, it essentially cedes the power of dictating the level of each year's RFS level to the petroleum industry based on what they voluntarily want to allow into the marketplace. And that's not the way it was supposed to work. The RFS was supposed to be a tool for market access, not market restrictions. We're also very concerned that, one point I guess I want to make is we do not view this as a one-year decision. Yes, today was about setting the 2014 renewable volume obligation levels, but it's the framework that it sets up. A finalized rule, and this is still a proposal, but a finalized rule has a force of law. And if this proposal were to be finalized, it would put in place a regulatory framework that creates a circular pattern of logic from which there is no off-ramp. In other words, it says, we're not selling enough higher blends of renewable fuels today, and so we have to lower the RFS number. Well, it takes away any motivation for the obligated parties to not just perhaps even, heaven forbid, invest in higher blends like E15, E30, and E85, but also it takes away any motivation for them to stop restricting the sale of those fuels from other independent retailers that would like to, and they have a lot of tools in their toolbox to restrict those sales. So we view this as not just a 2014 issue, but as setting up potentially a legal framework that will basically end the RFS as we know it. It will end it as a useful public policy to crack into the petroleum monopoly that's powered by their federal century of subsidies and their federal petroleum mandate. It's particularly alarming here in Iowa because we're in the process of wrapping up the harvest on the United States' largest corn crop, a corn crop that was planted and harvested, even though we had some tough weather, in response to the market demands that were out there, part of which was the expected RFS numbers that were in law. And so we're really pulling the rug out from underneath Iowa's and America's farmers at a time when corn prices right now are more or less below the cost of marginal production, and we do not have a farm bill safety net. I honestly am concerned that at some point in time we could look back at November 15th, 2013 and say that was the beginning of the next farm crisis. And so we're very concerned about this, not just for 2014, but for long term. It's also very disturbing that, in essence, this is, despite, you know, I wasn't on the API or whoever else had a conference call earlier today. I'm sure they tried to pretend that this wasn't their Christmas wish list come early. Obviously it is. And so I think it's a little bit concerning when the EPA just put out a proposed rule that gives Big Oil what it wants when Big Oil had no chance of gutting the RFS through the Congress. And so there was no need to go down this road. The justification for the waivers are not there. They're not legal. The facts on the ground do not justify them. And we will be using any tool that we can come up with during the comment period to try to get the final rule to not be what was put out today. With that, people will probably step on each other's toes here a little bit, because I apologize. We're just in Iowa. We don't have those fancy queue them up conference calls here, or at least we don't pay for them anyway. I'm cheap. So, but with that, we'll throw it up open to questions. Well, I'm glad I covered everything. So,
no. Hi, Monty. It's Duri Buscarin with Iowa Public Radio. How are you?
Not too bad.
Good. I'm seeing a number that the change would require about 3 billion fewer gallons of biofuel to be blended into gasoline in 2014. I was wondering if you knew maybe where that number came from and whether you'd consider it accurate.
I think if I'm understanding your question right, what I believe that is the statute calls for, and I should have that memorized, but it's a little over 18 billion gallons of total renewable fuels in 2014. And using their waiver authority, it would be just a little over at or a little over 15 billion gallons. So there's, you know, round it to the nearest billion, there's about a $3 billion whack to the RFS. And one thing I didn't point out that maybe I should is that shows just how absurd this proposal is. We are meeting the 2013 obligations this year. There's not going to be a problem. We're meeting them. And yet the 2014 obligations are actually set lower than the 2013 obligations, not just lower than they were supposed to be, because it's supposed to be an upward trend. It's not even just – it'd be horrible enough if they were holding the line at the 2013 levels. It's actually backing off and taking a step backwards. And there's – so how can we say you can't – we're already meeting the 2013 levels. How can you say we can't meet the 2013 levels in 2014? It makes no sense.
Yeah, because in the release, the EPA said that an increased production of ethanol and decrease in gasoline use led to a market saturation, and that was some of their reasoning behind it. I'm guessing you would disagree?
I totally disagree. What they're referring there to is that the vast majority of gasoline in America has 10% ethanol in it. That is true. That's a good thing. The whole point of the RFS, though, from being adopted back in December of 2007, was to go beyond E10, okay? There was at no time under any projection, the oil companies like to say, oh, you know, the projection was to use more fuel and now we aren't going to use as much, you know, da-da-da-da-da, so this whole thing is unworkable. The whole E10 saturation point is like a year early because of the reduced gasoline demand versus some of the early projections. It's not fundamentally different from what was projected back in 2007. When this bill was signed into law, passed by Congress and signed into law by then President Bush, everyone knew at that time that right about now or next year, you would be needing to blend fuels above E10. So to pretend this is a surprise or that somehow, well, wait, we're blending E10, so now we have to fundamentally, and I would even argue illegally, waive these numbers is a real cop-out. Every single place in America where higher blends have been put before consumers, there has been a robust response. We have well over 160-some E85 pumps in Iowa, and we also have, I think, 66, maybe 67 now, blender pumps in Iowa. When you give folks a range of options, yes, including E0, by the way, the non-ethanol blend, E0, E10, E15, E30, E85, the average, when we've gone out and talked to the retailers who offer this range of fuels to consumers, we say, well, what do you average? You know, you sell some 85, you sell some E0, everywhere in between. What's the average blend level? it's usually right around about 25% ethanol. That is years ahead of where we're at on the RFS schedule. So the point here is, it's not that that consumers won't buy these higher blends. It's that big oil is preventing them from having that choice at the pump. The RFS was designed to force through that monopoly, that roadblock, the options for consumers to have the choice to use higher blends, like E15 or E30 or E85. We're now saying, because big oil has successfully blocked many consumers from having those choices, we're going to gut the RFS. That puts the RFS on its head. It's rewarding big oil for doing exactly what the RFS was supposed to undo.
Okay. Does anyone else have a question? I feel kind of bad monopolizing you.
Well, I'll be on here as long as I need to. But if someone else wants to jump in first, that'd be fine. Or maybe it's just you and me now. I don't know. I've heard beeps on and beeps off, so go ahead.
Okay, great. I think that's pretty much all I needed. So there's this 60-day public comment period, but in your experience, do you think it's likely that any changes to these proposed rules will be made?
Well, in the past, there has not been significant changes made between the proposal and the final rule, but we've only done this a few times, so I don't think you can say there's a rock-hard path there. The EPA is required by law to take into consideration comments during this comment period, and so we're going to be asking every single Iowan that we can get a hold of to send in a comment that they need to stick by the law and enforce the law and not try to rewrite the law, which is Congress's job, not theirs. And there's too much at stake. So we are not giving up on the public comment period. There's also, you know, the justification for this, for the waiver is, for one of the waivers they used to reduce the corn ethanol number, is quite frankly not in the law and was specifically rejected. This whole notion of an infrastructure waiver, if you will, was specifically rejected by Congress during the adoption of the RFS. That makes it illegal. And I hope we don't have to go down that road, but certainly there's already been talk by some about looking at legal options. That's not our hope. Our hope is that someone in the White House will wake up and say, look, we've got to follow the law, we've got to follow the facts, we've got to follow common sense, and we've got to follow good public policy for cleaner fuels, consumer choice, and cutting petroleum dependence. And if that happens, we can get a better final rule.
It sounds like we have feedback, but that's all I need. Thanks so much, Monty. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
Yeah, it would appear someone might have us on speaker or something. If you do and can hit mute on your phone, that would be very, very appreciated. Are there any other questions?
Yeah, Monty. This is Danelle Heller from the Des Moines Register. Will this ruling affect, number one, any current operations, do you think, at ethanol or biodiesel plants? And number two, does it impact the consumers?
I think both. And I'm not going to say necessarily tomorrow, but certainly after this goes final, it's going to. On the ethanol side, you're likely, you know, ethanol is still about 70 cents a gallon cheaper than gasoline on the wholesale market. So, I don't see any potential that we're actually going to see like less E10 use or anything like that. But what you're going to see is a real slowdown in big oil's willingness to let E15 in the market. So, you know, I guess what I'm saying there is you're going to really kind of plateau the ethanol industry for a while, and we're going to have to be very aggressive in trying to, you know, work the economics on this instead of having some growth back in the ethanol production side. On biodiesel, you know, it's a little scarier. Right now the biodiesel industry is producing at a 2 billion gallon a year annualized rate. They're going to hit about 1.7 billion gallons of production for the year, but we're producing at a higher rate now because we were at a lower rate earlier in the year. This sets it at 1.28. The biodiesel tax credit is set to expire at the end of the year. So I think there is some legitimate concern that you could see a pull down a substantial reduction in biodiesel demand in 2014. Now, Iowa, will that mean Iowa plants? I don't know. Iowa plants have been pretty successful in the past. We're very close to both soybean oil, corn oil, animal fats. So we tend to be able to ride that out a little better than most. But if, you know, I've seen some numbers, and I'm not making this as a prediction, but I have seen some industry observers say you could see at least a 25% reduction in biodiesel demand next year. If those are accurate, I mean, some plants are going to shut down. Some people are going to be out of work. The other thing that's really, really bad on this is for the advanced biofuels and the cellulosic ethanol, the next generation biofuels and the cellulosic ethanol. You know, I don't think it will affect the projects in Iowa that we have right now, the POET DSM, the DuPont, the Quad County project, because they're already financed. They're well into construction. They'll be up and operating. All three of those will be up and operating next year. But it makes it real hard to see how you're going to raise the investment needed to build number two of each of those. You know what I mean? Because essentially what you're saying is, if you let this proposal stand, is we're happy at E10. We're not going to go beyond E10. And if all we need in this country is 10% ethanol blends, well, we've got more than enough corn to do that. You know, we're projected to have a 2 billion bushel carryout this year. That means at the end of we're harvesting the corn now, finishing that up. At the end of this marketing year, by the time we harvest next year's crop, we're supposed to still have 2 billion bushels sitting around in the bin because nobody wants them. There's no demand for them at the end of this year. And how is cellulosic going to get the financing and compete with that? So I really feel you could snuff cellulosic ethanol out in the crib with a proposal like this. It could be very damaging there. I hope I'm wrong on some of these things, but that's how we see it right now. Okay, any other questions?
I'll ask another one if no one else has. What kind of, it's sort of, ethanol has helped provide a floor, as I understand it, for corn prices. Do you think that those will be hurt with this kind of ruling?
There's no doubt about it. I mean, I think, you know, right now, you've got USDA with the supply and demand chart that shows that 2 billion bushel carryout that I just talked about. All right, I don't know if they have to wait to revise that until this rule goes final, because when they do that, it's based on, you know, current law and current market conditions, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if this proposal goes final, they're going to have to take a look at how much corn they expect to go into ethanol. My guess is that number will come down, and then that means a bigger carryout. I mean, usually, you know, exports is always an opportunity, but there are limitations there. And so I'm very concerned that we're going to see corn prices drop even further. And let me talk just a second about that, because we've had it so good since about 2006 that I think it's so easy to forget what life was like before then, you know, for 25 years before then. You know, we more or less had the price of corn below the cost of production for 25 years, from 1981 to 2005, on average. And you think, well, how is that possible? Well, we had a multi-billion-dollar farm bill with countercyclical payments and LDP payments and all the other price-triggered payments. And that kept corn artificially cheap, but didn't run farmers out of business. Not only do we not have any farm bill right now, but even the farm bill that's under consideration no longer contains a direct payment, an LDP, a countercyclical. It's basically an insurance program right now. And the point here is, we are very possibly heading into, for the first time since the 1930s, a time frame where the price of corn that a farmer can get is below their marginal cost. And the difference is no safety net. So I am very concerned. I grew up in the 80s. Was not fun in rural America. I am honestly, heartfelt, very concerned that the combination of these two policies from the Obama administration could fuel another farm crisis. I think the reason we have a farm bill debate where there was no argument about LDPs, countercyclical, direct payments and stuff, where farmers essentially said, yeah, let's do our part in lowering the cost to government. We don't need those. Part of their reasoning and confidence in doing that was because you had this demand driver called the RFS. If we now blow the RFS up, this not only affects energy policy and environmental policy, it very much affects farm policy. And so I've been off the farm a long time, but I still consider myself a farm kid, and I'm very concerned about that. And just to throw out some numbers, and this would vary from person to person, region to region, but we're told here in Iowa that if you're renting your land, and not everybody does, but a lot of your younger farmers and a lot of your marginal farmers are going to be renting their land. If you own it, it's paid off. Your cost structure would be lower. But for those folks that are renting some land, you need about $4.50 a bushel to break even and maybe have enough money to live on. Right now, corn's in, I think, the 430s. I didn't look today. It's been down in the 420s for a couple of weeks prior to that. So we're already kind of at that underwater position, and this is only going to push it further underwater. So this is very real. This is not I know on days like this there's a lot of rhetoric flying around, but those are cold, hard, scary numbers. All right, anyone else? Okay, well, just want to thank anyone for being on the call and for having a chance to get our side out. And if there's anything that we can do, please give TJ here or myself a call, and we're happy to follow up. Thank you very much.